So you've been in the car a fucking lot this week, yeah?
Yeah, a lot. I've been in the car a lot this week. Yeah, just driving, driving, driving. Literally from, I mean, one side of Maryland to the other. Been in far western Maryland, Hagerstown, and then I went all the way east over to Delaware.
Yeah, and we're like, we're not a deep state, but we're a pretty long state.
Yes, it's a long state. But yeah, and it's been interesting because this week is the first week. Yep, we didn't record last week, so no one got our raw reaction to the bridge collapsing
right
in our city, which was bananas because you were out of town. You were in
Louisiana. And it was on the national news. So, like, we woke up early in the morning because we're an hour behind.
Right.
It, and it was just like, I was getting texts in the middle of the night.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, for us, the bridge connects our beltway around our city.
Yeah.
So now you literally can't, mm-hmm. if you're at like exit one, you can't get to exit like 50
yep.
unless you go all the way around.
Yeah.
Oh, which is crazy.
Yep. I mean, and because it happened over spring break, when it happened, we weren't really feeling the brunt of the traffic.
Right.
Because we weren't dealing with school traffic, which is the worst traffic.
Yeah.
To be clear.
Absolutely. Summertime, I love the world.
Like, everyone thinks that it's rush hour traffic. And I'm like, no, it is school traffic.
Unless you're in D.C., then it's rush
hour. Then it's just forever
it's
traffic.
It's everybody.
It's forever traffic.
It's that 495 was built wrong.
Yes. It's that it's the devil's anus.
Right.
So anyways, but yeah, so now it's like, I mean, it took me 45 minutes to get here today.
Yeah.
And I was worried that it was going to take me an hour and I was going to be late for our mm-hmm. interview.
I will also say thank you to all of the people on our Instagram that reached out to see if we were okay.
I know.
Just because you know we live in Baltimore. That was so very sweet to wake up to. People being like, oh, my podcast hosts
yeah.
live in Baltimore.
It was very,
very sweet.
Sweet.
And it reminds me that like we are like a group of people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited.
Yeah.
That was great. Very, very kind. Yeah. I was fine, though.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Yeah.
But we're not here to talk about infrastructure and
cities.
No.
And dolphins, whatever the heck those are.
Okay.
If you know, you know. We're talking about rebuilding the bridge. We are here to talk about history.
On the rocks.
With Katie.
And Allie.
This is a podcast where we talk about famous women in history.
We talk about good women and bad women and fictional women and non-fictional women and sometimes very lesser known women from all types of places because women have nuance.
But keep in mind, we are drinking the entire time.
And we're not historians. And sometimes we drink yogurt. And
yeah.
It's okay.
Don't worry. This episode is all about gut health.
I wish it was because I am like... Need
your
in
guts,
need.
Guts
I'm in
not
need.
Okay.
I'm like, as I age, like I always used to be like, oh my God, I'll always be able to lose weight if I just keep eating and working out like this. I haven't changed my habits. I can't drop a fucking pound. It's really upsetting.
Well, maybe this cocktail will do the trick.
Okay. This is it. This yogurt. This is it.
But we know that you're busy because you are creating your own plan for what to do with about the Key Bridge.
I mean, you are an architect.
You're concerned.
And you are drawing up blueprints.
Schematics.
To like, you know, pitch to the state.
Yeah, exactly. So you're busy. We're all busy. And so we don't want you to take your eyes away from your very important work to look up what these women look like.
Yeah, forget that CAD design.
So we are going to describe them for you. We are going to get a little physical. Allie, who are you doing and what does she look like?
I am doing Iris Apfel, and she is like a very recognizable yeah. person. So we always see Iris in her golden years.
Mm-hmm.
She's usually pictured in her 70s plus. She has short white hair that is always styled and huge black thick-rimmed circle glasses with a red lip. As a young woman working in design, she was told, you aren't pretty. You'll never be pretty, so it's good that you have style.
Ugh,
yikes.
Whoa.
Because she is pretty, but her style definitely outshines her looks. She has patterned fabrics and clothes from all over the world, but is probably most famous for her extreme use of costume jewelry. Her bangles, her draping necklaces, her scarves that come in all shapes and sizes and ties. I don't know how this woman does all the things she does with scarves. So if you haven't seen Iris, stop your blueprints and look her up. She's amazing. Who are you doing and what does she look like?
I am doing Maria Louise Baldwin. Maria was a statuesque black woman with an oval face, almond-shaped, wide-set eyes, and dark hair that she often wore waved and short. She wore high starched collars, and in both photos of her, she has some kind of a striped either top or dress on. She was a very sophisticated woman, and people were often left in awe of her.
Wow.
And that's what she looked like.
Sophisticated woman.
Seriously sophisticated.
Well, can you tell me about this yogurt smoothie yes. that I'm about to have?
So I'm calling this the Berry Best because she is a teacher, and I was looking up classic teacher puns that appear on mugs and A+ test scores.
I like
and
stamps.
So it's called the Berry Best. It is gin, ginger liqueur, Greek yogurt, plain, sweetened lime juice, and blueberry jam. And you shake that all up together and you top it off with just a splash of champagne.
Amazing.
Cheers.
Cheers. It's very good.
I like it a lot.
Oh my gosh. I can't believe it. Thank you for this yogurt drink. I will say this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is like a little bit of like a school lunch drink. You get that little yogurt packet.
Yeah.
And then also, every teacher needs alcohol from now until June. Mm-hmm. Once you mm-hmm. come back from mm-hmm. spring break, next year, spring break, Easter's April 22nd next year. It's a month
Bananas.
Later.
No
a month.
Thanks.
Yeah. But this is great. Thank you for this.
Oh, and you garnish it with mint. I didn't say that, but
teachers everywhere love you for this.
Honestly, this is delicious.
Yeah, you're back into big herb season too.
Big herb season. I got this at the farmer's market last week.
Big herb
so I was
energy.
Like, I gotta use it.
Thank you, Olivia.
Thanks, Olivia. She took me to the farmer's market, showed me the tricks of the trade. So anyways, what do you know about Maria Louise Baldwin?
I know that she's a teacher.
Yeah,
there you go.
That's it. All right. So there was not a lot on her, which is like such a tragedy because she's a very, very cool person. And the way that it's like, it's kind of hard to like create a narrative when all you have is bullet point facts about
right,
someone.
Yeah.
So this is just kind of going to be like a list of like the cool stuff she did and her accomplishments, which we don't have a ton of, you know, from black women in the late 1800s.
Right. Give
so
me her
let's
top,
get the
top
list
10.
Out, you know?
Yeah.
So my sources were Wikipedia and this great article from the Bay State Banner written by Anthony W. Neal. He had so much information there that like wasn't anywhere else, and it was super helpful. So thank you, Anthony, for your article. I definitely just like copy and pasted a lot of it and put it right into this bullet point list that I have in front of me.
Excellent.
Okay. Maria Louise Baldwin was born to
perfect middle name.
Yes.
Classic.
To Peter L. and Mary E. Baldwin in Cambridge, Massachusetts on September 13th, 1856. In Cambridge, she attended the Sargent Primary and Alston Grammar Schools. She graduated from Cambridge High School in 1874 and from Cambridge Teachers Training School the following year. After graduating, she wrote to then Cambridge School Board member Horace E. Scudder, asking him to help her secure a teaching position. Scudder told her, however, that he felt like it was her duty to go south and work for those with more limited educational opportunities. It kind of felt to me like he was like, you're a black teacher, so you should be teaching black kids in the South.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, you shouldn't be here educating the youth of Cambridge.
Not
you know?
The safest time to be in the South.
No. And because if you don't know, Cambridge is where Harvard is located. Sure. So this is like seen.
And MIT.
And MIT. It's like seen as this like very intellectual upper crust area.
It's pretty much an ivory tower all by itself.
Exactly.
Right.
And, you know, and she's like, well, this is like my literal hometown. Like, I was born and raised here. Like, I think I can educate the people. Anyway.
And she was educated there.
Yes. Yes. Crazy. So, unable to land a teaching job in Cambridge, she headed for Chestertown, Maryland.
What a great little town.
Hi. Welcome, Maria.
We take everybody in Maryland.
We love you. So, she teaches in Maryland for 2 years, which I do, you know, it's hard because it's everything says like she went south, which like I do understand that that is the geographical direction that she went. But I also don't love like categorizing like Maryland as like a southern state.
Yeah, I think but the Mason-Dixon line does go through our state.
I say that we're in a category of our own. We're mid-Atlantic. That's my big thing.
Okay.
We're a mid-Atlantic state.
So just us, Delaware, and what? Jersey? Virginia? Because Virginia's south.
No, Virginia's southern. Yeah, Virginia's okay. Totally southern.
Well,
us in Delaware.
Okay, so us in Delaware.
The two of us.
Exactly. Yeah, really depends who you ask whether we're north or south. I've gone places on vacation with Jake where people ask if we're from the south because of our accent. Mm. And I've gone places where people ask if we're from the north because of our accent.
Yep.
Because I don't think I have an accent, but when everybody makes fun of me, then I really know I have an accent.
But yeah, it's just that we're in a funny little crevice of the U.S.
Yeah.
And we are technically featured in Southern Living Magazine, which... You know, you
and I mean, like half of our citizens fought for the South in Civil War, but
half
we did not secede. We did not secede.
No, we did not.
but we were a slave state. Very confusing.
I know.
We had an identity crisis. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's why we're so fucked up.
I know. Well, welcome to Chestertown, Maria. Be fucked up with us.
Okay, she teaches there for 2 years, but then she comes back in 1880 because her father passes away suddenly. Very sad. And she was honestly still believing that she was meant to teach in her hometown. So she pursued a teaching career in Cambridge, and it took her 2 years to land a job here. And this is with people in the community desperately wanting her to be a teacher there. They literally were protesting in support of her to be a teacher in their own community. And the board just, like, didn't want to okay it.
Like, yeah, she's from here. We like her. She's our neighbor.
Yeah. So, finally, in 1882, the Cambridge School Department hired her as a teacher at the Agassiz School, making her the only Black public school teacher in Cambridge.
Whoa. Mm-hmm.
The only one. The Agassiz School was a primary grade school, then located on the corner of Sacramento and Oxford Streets, and it didn't take long for Maria to earn a positive reputation that, I mean, exceeded the walls of the school. Like, everyone in town was talking about what a great teacher she was. She was routinely ranked as one of the best teachers in the city, and by 1889, she was named principal of the school.
No way. And is this a mixed race school?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And then she was named master of the school. I didn't even know that was a position.
Yeah,
but
like
it's
a
above
headmaster.
Oh, a headmaster. Oh, a headmaster.
So it
okay.
Must be like she was in charge of the primary and secondary.
Yeah.
Usually, right? That's what the headmaster is?
Yeah, I think so.
More than a principal?
And you know what? That now makes sense because I always thought it was just like pretentious that my school had a headmaster instead of a principal. But now it makes sense because it was a K-12 school.
Yeah, you need a headmaster.
Okay. Wow. Okay, well, she's headmaster.
Yeah, my school had two principals, one for middle school, one for high school.
Really?
And the headmaster was in charge of both of them.
Hmm.
So
didn't realize.
There's the thing.
All right. Well,
since you don't know the inner workings of Baltimore Lutheran.
You mean Concordia Prep?
You're from Cockeysville, Maryland? No. Where is it? Lop Raven?
I don't know where your school is.
We've known each other for 50 years.
Anyways. So she's headmaster. This makes her one of just two women in the Cambridge public school system and the only African-American in all of New England to hold such a post. That's incredible.
All of New England.
She supervised an all-white staff of 12 teachers who were responsible for about 500 students. 98% of those students were white. So it was mixed race, but like just a little bit. But yeah, 98% white students, all white teachers, and the headmaster is a Black woman. That's insane.
Well, I want to tell you how insane this is because I just Googled how many Black female principals there are now.
How many?
just under 11% of the country's public school principals are black, and black women make up only 7% nationally.
Oh my gosh.
So like the fact that she's doing this in like 1889 is...
it's insane.
Insane. Well, also what it shows you is the Jim Crow laws weren't in effect yet.
Mm-hmm.
So the during Reconstruction, like it was like, okay, everybody's free. And then the white congressman figured out a way to put people down again. Mm-hmm. So this is like that little gap of time.
Yep.
What a precious time.
I know. Maria was also a responsible educator and made sure that she was staying educated as well. She took classes at Harvard and other institutions so that she could stay on top of not only the material that was being taught to her students, but also keeping up with any advancements in the field of education.
Mm.
Her pedagogy was like out the wazoo.
She's like, let me do professional, let me professionally develop myself.
Exactly. Because she's like, well, if new things are happening in math, I want to know. Like, and if there's a better way to teach math to kids, like, I want to know. Like,
she was and just now so... I whine all the time about having to do continuing education classes.
And this is all evident in the programs that she helped to incorporate into the public school system. She organized the first parent-teacher group in the Cambridge public school system. She created new and novel ways of teaching mathematics and inspired the creation of a Museum of Science program within the school system. Under her direction, the Agassiz School became the only public school in Cambridge to create an open-air classroom, getting kids more outside. Which we know is always good for them.
Oh, yes.
And she introduced art classes to the curriculum. And she introduced the practice of hiring a school nurse, which was like...
thank God.
Thank goodness.
Somebody has to keep the pads.
Yes.
We need menstrual pads locked up somewhere.
One of her students was the famous poet E.E. Cummings. And he would later write about her, praising her, saying, "Ms. Baldwin, the dark lady mentioned in my first non-lecture, in quotations, and a lady, if ever a lady existed, was blessed with a delicious voice, charming manners, and a deep understanding of children. Never did any demi-divine dictator more gracefully and easily rule a more unruly and less graceful populace. Her very presence emanated an honor and a glory, the honor of spiritual freedom, not mere freedom from, and the glory of being, not, like most extant mortals, really undead, but actually alive. From her, I marvelingly learned that the truest power is gentleness."
Wow. So is he talking about Saint Maria Baldwin?
Have any of your students ever said that about you?
Don't think so.
God, I almost named this cocktail the Demi-Divine Dictator because I fucking love that word. But then I was like, people are going to get the wrong idea about her.
I fucking wish anybody would call me a Demi-Divine Dictator. I don't think anybody's ever used any, like, divine-esque holy words to describe me. Not one.
I just, like... it's such a glowing quote.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he just thinks the world of her.
Clearly.
And when she wasn't teaching or learning or managing an entire school and potentially school system, she was out lecturing. She won praises all over the country for her lectures, which covered Harriet Beecher Stowe and Presidents Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln. Her best-known presentation was the one on Harriet Beecher Stowe, which she first delivered at the annual Washington's birthday celebration at the Brooklyn Institute of Arts and Sciences in 1897. She was the first African-American and first woman to be invited to present this annual lecture. A Boston Globe reporter once attended one of her lectures and then described her as being a very cultivated woman, most pleasing in manner, and a person who spoke interestingly on almost any subject except for herself, where she was very modest and unassuming. Another reporter similarly noted, "Personally, Ms. Baldwin is charming and upon almost any topic converses most interestingly. In the rich, low voice, carefully enunciated and well-chosen words of a New England woman of the best type." People loved her.
She like must be so well spoken and like put together. And you know how sometimes you like hear people give like a speech or a sermon and you're just like blown away, like, wow, that person really knows what they're talking about. I think that a lot during like TED Talks. And then I try to put together like a 2-minute speech to tell somebody and I'm like, I sound like a fucking idiot.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like, it's again, like, I love to use this compliment. Like, if she had a cult, I would probably join it. Sure. You know, like, I just think that she was probably so enigmatic and like, I don't know. It's just like, she just sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Like, she's like the Jackie Robinson of teachers, just like busting down those color barriers.
Right.
She also would often give readings from the works of African-American poet, novelist, and playwright Paul Laurence Dunbar. And her home became a sanctuary for lots of like Black-centric literary activities. So she would hold weekly readings for African-American students attending Harvard, which, like, I didn't even know that there were many Black students attending Harvard at this time, but apparently they were, and they probably felt really isolated. So she opened up her home to them and was like, come and hang out and, like, let's read poetry and writings from Black writers so, like, we can all just, like, bask in this and, like, not feel
isolated
and, like, bad about celebrating, like, what we have accomplished. Like, it was just, like, such a cool sense of community that she was creating in her home for all these students.
Right. What a good way to foster, like, young people.
I know. And one of these students that would come to her house was W.E.B. Du Bois.
Whoa.
I know.
Big timer.
I know. She also taught summer courses for teachers at the Hampton Institute in Virginia and the Institute for Colored Youth in Pennsylvania. And she was a supporter of Charlotte Hawken Brown's Palmer Institute in North Carolina. In the late 1870s, she joined several civil rights groups, becoming a member and secretary of the debate club, the Banneker Society. She used her position as
Benjamin Banneker.
Oh, is that who that is?
Who's He's from Maryland.
Really?
I'm pretty sure. His house is over right at, you know, in Old Ellicott City, that little cabin up at the top of the hill? Uh-huh. That's the Benjamin Banneker house.
That's cool.
I think it's the oldest house in Maryland.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Well, here he is. And
she must have learned about him when she came and taught Maryland for 2 years.
She used her position here in the society to advocate for women's suffrage and the importance of childhood education. She was one of the speakers at the 35th annual banquet of the New England and Massachusetts Women's Suffrage Association. Nearly 400 members and guests attended the event, including representatives of the Massachusetts legislature. And of course, she used this opportunity to talk about the importance of education. According to the Globe, she made one of the best speeches of the evening on the teacher and social reform. She told the audience that a teacher's work was more sacred than that of a minister, and that children should always be given the closest attention by teachers because of the latent possibilities in their young lives. Along with talking about historical figures and education, she also made more pointed speeches when she went down south that were anti-lynching. So she also, like, wasn't afraid to, like, get very political and pointed. But she also... I kind of like, too, that, like, when she would go down south, she would get more intense with her speeches and, like, very direct of, like, you know, this is the problem. Mm. So, I don't know.
It's you.
It's you. She volunteered her time raising money for the education of African-American children and young adults. On March 27th, 1900, at Madison Square Garden, she and W.E.B. Du Bois addressed a meeting to raise funds for a free kindergarten for Black children in New York City. She also served on a planning committee that held an April festival in Boston, and all the proceeds of this would also provide aid to a kindergarten for Black children in Atlanta. She knew that kindergarten was important. Again, it's like back in the 1800s.
Hi!
She also routinely petitioned organizations for more money to support the education of young Black men and women in academia so they could have more Black teachers in the public school. Like, again, she's so forward thinking. She's like, because, like, a lot of the social programs that were being built were like, let's get them into blue collar work, you know, which is, like, also important. But she was like, yeah, but there's nothing here to help them get into, you know, academia. Like, there's nothing here to get them into anything but blue-collar work. So it was like, maybe we should give them more opportunities.
Right.
So So she was elected Assistant Secretary of the Massachusetts Teachers Association in 1900, and she became the second president of the Boston Literary and Historical Society in 1903. She belonged to numerous civic and educational organizations, both black and white. Among the white-dominated organizations were the 20th Century Club, the Cantabrigia Club, and the Boston Ethical Society. Then in 1893, along with her close friends Josephine and Flora, she founded the Women's Era Club, one of the first African-American women's clubs. And the club published the Women's Era, which was a periodical published by all black women.
I know.
I don't know how she has time for all this. She was a member.
You know what? She wasn't spending her time scrolling on Facebook.
Yeah, that's true. We're waiting in line at Starbucks.
How dare you judge my Starbucks?
She was a member of the board of directors and in 1903 was elected president of the Boston Literary and Historical Association.
Oh my God.
I know.
Stop
she's so
it.
Many things.
Being things in Boston is like so hard.
It's so hard. And she was literally all of them. And this was an organization of leading black activists who supported black civil rights. She was one of the first women members of the Niagara Movement, another civil rights group, and she was a member of the Committee of 40, which organized the founding of the NAACP.
Ugh, shut up.
I know. As we said, she was an advocate of women's suffrage. She was an early member of the board of the Boston branch of the NAACP. She was active in supporting the Robert Gold Shaw House, which was a settlement house in South Boston. And during the First World War, she was central in founding the Soldiers' Comfort Unit, which supported black soldiers stationed at Fort Devens. After the war, the group changed its name to the League of Women for Community Service, and she served as president of the league until 1922.
She's doing a lot. That's like, I mean, she's really spending her time wisely. She's like, YOLO.
Yeah.
I have one life to live. It's time to go.
Yep. Then on January 9th, 1922, Maria was addressing the council of the Robert Gold Shaw House Association at the Copley Plaza Hotel in Boston, and in the middle of her speech, she collapsed and died.
No!
Heart disease.
Number one killer in the United States.
I know. Can you believe it?
I mean, natural killer.
I'm so scared of it. She was 65 years old.
Oh my gosh, that's so young.
So young. And just like in the middle of a speech, just collapses and dies.
I mean, it's a good way. I mean, it's dramatic.
It's so
least.
Dramatic.
Please be dramatic. If nothing else.
Her life reads out predominantly as just like a straight list of accomplishments and things she was a part of and things that she did. Because that's really all we know about her. She was a very private person. She never married, and neither did her sister Alice. Her biographer, Kathleen Wyler, speculates, perhaps Maria and Alice Baldwin valued their professional lives over marriage, or they may merely have preferred to remain single. That we have no evidence of Maria's romantic relationships with either men or women does not mean that they had no relationships. It means that this part of their history, like so much of the inner lives of black women of this generation, is simply unknown. And I think that that is such a good point, that like it is just like this lost thing that like I just feel like there's so many black women of this era that like we just don't know a whole lot about their personal lives.
Well, and it makes me think about when you did the episode on that midwife who kept that journal. It's like the only reason we have any details about the women in that community is because we happen to have this like one important document. And it's like, so unfortunately, either many of these women weren't able to keep documents because they didn't have availability to the resources, or documents that they kept were destroyed or lost to time. So yeah, it's just it's a whole culture of women and movement that we just don't have any personal view.
Yeah. But doesn't mean we can't take pride in all the stuff that we know that she did.
Right.
You know, which is so important. Like, you know, even if we don't have this like biological legacy from Maria, I mean, her presence is still felt all over Cambridge. Her home from 1892 on has been preserved as the Maria Baldwin House and was designated as a National Historic Landmark. It is privately owned and not open to the public, which is a bummer, but that's okay. And on February 12th, 2004, the Agassiz School was officially renamed the Maria L. Baldwin School. The campaign was initiated by an eighth grade student at the school. That's so sweet. And actively supported by other students and the principal.
Did he call her a demi-divine dictator?
A demi-divine. She is noted on the Boston Women's Heritage Trail for her connection with the League of Women for Community Service. And the entire Agassiz neighborhood in Cambridge was renamed Baldwin in 2020. And that is the story of Maria Baldwin.
Beautiful.
I know.
I absolutely adore her. She just seems so fun.
Yeah.
And, like, so for me, like, mm-hmm. I'm on, like, two committees at my school, right? And it takes up all my fucking time. Like, that list of committee, I think, like, a lot of times people think that there are people on committees who are, like, figureheads. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, they show up sometimes and blah, blah, blah. But then, like, the grunt workers on committees that get shit done mm-hmm. and, like, do subcommittees and make sure things happen, that's, like, who Maria is. And she's on, like, 10,000 committees.
And, like, without the internet or smartphones or anything, like, she is, like, on the Telegram. Beep, 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 beep. Getting on that fucking horn.
She's Morse coding on the Telegram. That's amazing. Did she invent a new technology as well?
Oh, God.
I'm obsessed with that.
It's just like anytime I can do that, the beep, 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 I want. I choose to do it.
You have to.
I've noticed that about myself.
We have to really get into Samuel Morse anytime we can.
For this throwback to our conversation about what men we would cover. Samuel Morse, number one on the list.
No, excuse me. First episode of Him Story on the Rocks.
Yeah, and you know what's so funny is, like, the way that I feel about, like, needing to do that noise as much as possible, I've been realizing about myself, and I'm doing it literally right now, that, like, if I have something in my brain that, like, I've been wanting to get out, I will shove it into any conversation at any point.
Oh, okay.
I will force it in.
Good.
And it's something I've become very conscious of, like, recently, and I'm really trying not to do it, but I cannot help myself.
No, it's perfect.
It's not.
I mean, for me, the things that I say to myself in private, like, I can't believe this, I can't believe that, blah, 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 as soon as I have a sip of alcohol, they all come out. All of them.
Mine's not even alcohol-induced. It's just, like, I have these things running around in my brain, and I'm like, I have to say this.
Yeah.
One way or another.
Good. I have up, like, real roadblocks. Sober Alley has up real roadblocks of, like, even saying normal things. Like, hey, what time is it? How's the weather? I can't do it. I can't do it. If you ever meet me sober, I'm not going to be as fun.
That's not true.
I know. I'm a blast. I'm an actual physical blast.
All right. We'll be right back.
Yeah, we got more to talk about. I like texting Paige right now.
What is she doing? Like, she looks different, you know, because I've been listening to music for a little bit. She got a gold cap tooth with an ivory white heart. It looks bananas.
You know what? If we're getting into tooth design, we may as well.
Why not? You know, Paige has a little gold heart on one of her teeth.
I know she has a gold tooth. I didn't know she had a heart. Wait.
Well, she has one little tiny girl.
Uh-huh.
And then she also got a gold heart, like, lasered onto her tooth. It's so cool.
It is very, very cool.
Yeah.
I'm not that cool. So.
No. God, no. I can't even get a cavity filled.
I'm barely
in
this cool.
In this town.
It's because of my insurance. Yeah,
that's true.
It's not because of my mom.
Literally, I'm in the mindset of, like, well, I'm, like, going to pay off my car in 2 months. So I'm like, then I can get decent health insurance and, like, actually get this cavity filled. It's going to be glorious.
I cannot believe it. I can't wait to have someone drill into my tooth.
It's going to be amazing. So anyways, we're back. Part two.
You want to know what we're drinking?
I do want an adorable cocktail.
It is called the Altar of Accessories.
Okay.
And it is Aperol and gin and lime juice. Mm. And then you shake that up in a cocktail shaker, pour it over ice with then dump club soda on top, stir it up, and do a ring of lemon.
I love
like
it.
A big old ring.
Cheers.
Cheers. Just right.
Mm-hmm.
I spilled a lot on myself.
Me too. Mm. I want to be drinking this on your back porch in 80 degree weather. Yep. That's what I would like.
Well, you're invited.
I'm manifesting
over
it
all the time.
I'm manifesting it. It's the day of my dreams.
I mean, you can literally just take over my house the entire time I'm in London. Do you want to do that?
Sure. Why not?
You can just have it. You can have the whole back porch. Skate That's ramp it. And all.
No, I meant like also with you. Like, oh, I would like you to be here.
Okay, I'll come.
I do have a porch.
I'll come over in London. Okay, so what do you know about Iris Apfel?
All I know is that she always comes up and the pictures of her are amazing.
She's fantastic.
And it's always just like big glasses. Like, we did it in the physical, but it's like big glasses, lots of accessories, lots of color. I just... You know, we talk a lot about the beige babies, you know, and like I am like kind of, I feel like I'm like half in the beige world, half in the color world, you know, like, and I just appreciate people who embrace color.
Sure.
Because it's something I'm just a little bit afraid of.
Well, I definitely felt like a calling to it after doing this episode, because like my home, we've talked about before, is very colorful, mm-hmm. very kitschy. But my outfits are not.
Oh, that's
like,
true.
Like, I wear a lot of just black and neutrals. Mm-hmm. And sometimes to a point where it's like I see something colorful and I won't buy it because I'm like, well, if I wear it once and everybody's like, oh, she's wearing color now. Like, I don't want people to think that's weird. Like, yeah. I get that, like, so in my head about it.
And it's like so bananas how much we think other people are thinking about
us.
Yeah,
nobody gives a shit.
No one, like, I think that all the time. I'm like, well, if I do this, then people are expecting. Like, I think that about makeup.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I would like to start wearing mascara, but then if I start wearing mascara and then I don't one day, people are going to be like,
you look tired.
Yes! I am deathly afraid of the you look tired comment because,
yo, if,
you know, I just, my Aunt Needs told that story when I was younger and it scarred me for life.
Yeah, girl.
Aunt Needs, I love you. But I remember so clearly because I forget she listens.
Paige told me that story as well about really? Her at the florist shop. Somebody was like, oh, yeah. You look tired. And she's like, fuck you.
Yeah.
Like, rude.
Yeah. Like, my Aunt Niece, she was, like, wearing makeup or something for a while. And then, like, she, like, didn't wear it one day. And, like, someone was like, you look terrible. Or, like, you look tired. Or, like, whatever. And she was like, what?
This is why I would never want to be a celebrity. You can't even, like, run to 7-Eleven.
Yeah. Because you know then it's like, you're off the rails.
Right. You're insane. You've gone crazy. Shave your head. Why don't you?
Daniel Radcliffe's not doing okay.
Be Amanda Bynes.
Oh, man.
Oh, I know. God. Oh, also, God. Her birthday yesterday. Her and producer, yes! Same day, same year. That's his soulmate.
Ended up with me.
Amanda, if you're listening, I have your soulmate. Come get him.
We love you. God.
Also, I'm very sorry for the tragedy.
Everything.
Yeah, my God.
Fuck.
Okay.
Okay.
Iris Barrel was born in...
Barrel?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Can you spell that last name for me?
B-A-R-R-E-L. Barrel.
Perfect.
Did I say it right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just wouldn't know if it was a B-E-R-Y-L situation.
Oh, I say no.
Barrel.
It is not. Okay. Iris Barrel. Was
Barrel like the thing under the dog's neck?
Yeah. What?
Yeah.
I wanted to say yeah, but then I was like, I don't know what you mean.
Okay. You know, like, St. Bernards are always pictured like the mug root beer dog with
oh,
the barrels.
I would have felt like barrel, like, full of wine. Not like a barrel, like, a dog, like, holding medicine to take out to the freaking...
To the alpine skiers.
All right.
Katie. Sorry. I'm off the rails. I'm off the rails. All right. We made 3 gin cocktails in a row. This is my kryptonite. I cannot keep going like this.
Well, we've got like 40 more minutes, so you gotta put on your big girl pants.
Okay, I got this.
Okay. Feel free to make the show funnier, though. Okay.
I don't know if that was funny, though. Nobody likes when I do that.
Yes, they do. Are you kidding me?
I don't know.
That's the whole reason people listen. Honestly. Okay. Iris Barrel was born in Queens, New York City on August 29th. 1921, so a year before your girl dropped dead.
Wow.
Is
yeah,
when
you're
my
right.
girl was
you're
born
right. Ships in the night.
Really. And she does talk like she was from Queens, New York.
Good for her.
I love it.
Good for her.
She was the only child of Samuel Beryl, who owned a glass and mirror business, and his Russian wife, Sid Beryl, who owned a fashion boutique. Both of her parents were Jewish. She was heavily influenced by her mom. She said her mom loved wearing accessories and taught her to worship at the altar of accessories. She said her mom could do amazing things with scarves that she still cannot do. And that she learned from her mom that you should get standard clothing because you can dress it up and dress it down. Get your little black dress, put on some sneaks and 10 necklaces and go out. Or get your little black dress and put on heels and hoops and a headscarf and just be wild.
Can I tell you another thing that infiltrated my brain and has never left?
Do it.
You once told me, look at yourself in the mirror before you go out.
Take something off.
Yes. But I already dress so simplistically.
Katie's going out nude.
Dude. Fully nude.
Well, I learned that from ANTM.
I worship at the altar of ANTM.
Tyra Banks was like, you shouldn't be wearing all four jewelries, which I break all the time. Necklace, earrings, bracelets, rings. I wear all of them every day. But she was like, you should absolutely only be doing one of earrings, necklaces, and one of rings, bracelets.
You know what's so funny is I also think that that show had a fucked up effect on my head.
Yeah, because plus size models were skinnier than us.
I know.
Crazy.
And also I think that that show also drilled into my head the uniform that we always talk about, which is black shirt and jeans.
Iris talks about the fucking uniform.
No. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I felt a calling after this episode. I might change my life.
Okay.
Probably not, but I might. She was raised on a farm by her parents and grandparents, but she often rode the subway into the city to explore Manhattan, where she fell in love with Greenwich Village, as we all do.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. She was a whole full child that would go into antique shops just to look around like a woman after my own heart.
Ugh, a dream.
And they helped her start. These antique shops helped her start her extraordinary jewelry collection that from a young age. She fell in love with this one antique shop in the basement of a building in Greenwich Village where she saw this piece of jewelry and saved up over time 65 cents to buy it. I know. And the owner just loved her. This old man who would wear a monocle was obsessed with the fact that this young girl liked antiques. Because, that's not who you see going into antique shops.
No, it's not.
Yeah. During the Depression, her whole family knew how to sew and drape and glue and paint just so they could add some flair to their outfits on a small budget. And she thinks it's a shame that most young people don't know how to sew so they can change an outfit to fit them the way they want. Most things you buy at a Walmart or a Target aren't made for your body.
Mm-hmm.
And there's three easy stitches that you could learn to fix that problem.
Oh, no, I save them on Pinterest all the time.
I'm always I cut a lot of t-shirts. Uh-huh. I do a lot of 80s styles cutting, which is
I know.
Terrible. I look like a weirdo. It's so out of style. Whatever. I love it. In the 40s, she was one of the first women wearing jeans. So she had this amazing idea. She was like, I want to wear a gingham turban, big hoops, and jean trousers. And she kept going to this man clothing store, uh-huh. and was like, I want to buy a pair of jeans. And they would kick her out and be like, you cannot. We're not going to let you buy jeans. And then, eventually they were just like, fine, take the jeans so that she could leave them alone.
She was like, it's the, 30s, 40s?
Yeah.
She was like, just let me buy the fucking pants.
Yeah, I just want some pants.
I was going to say roaring 20s, but we're definitely past that.
Yeah, we are. But it's remember we did those motorcycle girls during the war who were getting arrested in the Midwest for wearing pants. So she is in Manhattan, so she's getting away with a little bit, but she was not supposed to wear denim like that. She
crazy. Demi Divine denim.
What a connection. She studied at art history at the New York University and attended art school at the University of Wisconsin. But always tells people she does not feel that art is something that you can teach and that style is something that you can teach. She thinks it's a gut feeling, and I heavily believe that because mm-hmm. when I am trying to style things, I just don't have an eye for it. Like, I can see how somebody styles a room mm-hmm. and do it, but I can't, like, come up with it on my own. Mm-hmm. She says the process of finding what to wear is better than wearing it, and the process of getting dressed for a party is better than going to the party, which I don't agree with. I, like, crawl up on a ball and, like, cry in my closet.
I do like that idea, though.
Yeah, like, it's like a ceremony.
Well, and it's also, like, if I had more money and, like, buy clothes that I want, like, yes, it would feel a little bit better.
Sure, but I think, like, the party. Her stuff is all from, like, antique stores.
Yeah.
And shit. Mm-hmm. Like, her stuff, like, when she... I saw videos of her haggling in her old age, and they were like, that's $15. And she'd be like, that's too much. And I was like, $15? That's, like, nothing. She, like, really has... I mean, at the point when this documentary is being made, she, like, has... wardrobe upon wardrobe upon wardrobe, and she's still like, no, that's too much.
Yeah,
I'm not buying that. As a young woman, she was a copywriter for a women's wear daily, earning $15 a week, and she was also an assistant illustrator for Robert Goodman. And she, at this time, realized that, like, the reason that she liked people in Harlem was because they had style. Mm. And she was like, in Greenwich Village, they had style. She was like, if I go downtown, they don't have style. They wear black. That's just a uniform. That's what she said. And I was like, oh, no.
Yep.
That's me. Mm-hmm. On February 22nd, 1948, she married Carl Apfel. 2 years later, they end up launching a huge textile firm together that we are going to talk about that they ran until 1992 when they retire.
Oh my God.
So first of all, I need you to understand they're the cutest couple in the fucking world when they're interviewed together, and they're both so New York and so cute. That they were married for 67 years before Carl died in 2015 when he was 100 years old.
Oh my gosh.
I know. And he said, you never know what's going to happen with her. It's not a doll marriage. She did want to get eloped and just keep the money that her parents were going to spend on the wedding, but her parents and grandparents really wanted a wedding. So they got married with 150 people present. She wore a pink lace wedding dress, and she, 67 years later, still had the shoes. And she said, they're back in style. If you keep anything long enough, it comes back around.
That is true.
It is true. So she spent a lot of time working for this interior designer, Eleanor Johnson, decorating apartments for resale and honoring, you know, the talent of, like, resourcing items. Like, mm-hmm. that's what she would try to do. And this is where her and her husband's business came from, which is called Old World Weavers.
Ooh.
So one day she's working to try to get things for an apartment, and she wanted a fabric that doesn't exist. And she had happened to go to school with this girl whose dad was a weaver. So she goes to this girl's dad, and she was like, this is the pattern that I want, and I can't find it anywhere. And he weaves it for her to put in this house. And then he comes back to her and goes, do you have, like, any other patterns, like, in your brain that you want that just don't exist? So they start this business together called Old World Weavers, where they do exact reproductions of cloth from around the world from the 1718 and early 1900s. And they would get it as close to the material and the pattern as possible to put in people's homes.
That's so cool.
It is. Like, it was, it's like you know when you have an image in your head of, like, this is the dress I want to wear to that wedding, and then you can't find the dress, so you just quit and buy something else?
Uh-huh.
She was not having that.
Okay.
She was like, we can make fabric. Like, let's just make it if it doesn't exist.
Wow, I just do not think that way.
nor do I. Well, but then because of this, she starts to travel a lot because she finds all of her clothes, fabric, and jewelry herself. Mm. She never orders stuff or has buyers get stuff for her. Her and her husband went all around the world finding things. They are literally everywhere. Their business showroom is located, or was located, at 115 East 57th Street in Manhattan. Over her career, Iris took part in a variety of design restorations, most importantly, including the White House. 9 separate presidents went to her because they wanted the old world fabric so that the White House looked the way it did, including Harry S. Truman, Dwight D. Eisenhower, John F. Kennedy, meaning Jackie Kennedy, Lyndon B. Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton. All got White House pieces from Iris.
That's so cool.
Amazing. She said that the White House contract was among one of the easiest for old world weavers because, as clients, they generally wanted to replicate something that was already in the White House. Mm-hmm. With the exception of Jacqueline Kennedy, mm-hmm. who hired a Parisian designer and, as Ira said, Frenchied up the White House. So then after the Kennedys left, she had to start all over again. Which, as we know, Jacqueline Kennedy, like, famously got an Emmy for her redecoration mm-hmm. and, like, television series in the White House. So, like, good for you, girl. Other than the White House, she had interesting clients all over the country and all over the world. And they wanted fabric and design that no one else had. So they were traveling Europe finding it. Through the business, the couple traveled from place to place to place, finding non-Western artisanal clothing. And she wore a lot of the clothing, like kimono-style things, to high society parties, very drapey. She would find the fabric and pair it with, like, a skinny pant and heels, you know? So mm-hmm. she is, like, pairing, like, this old world and new world ideas. Mm-hmm. And her husband, everywhere they went, wore 3 cameras around his neck because it took way too long to switch lenses. And his wife was always doing amazing things. And he wanted to photograph right away.
My husband has a phone in his pocket that can take perfect pictures in an instant. Never a photo of me.
Right. All chimneys.
All chimneys. My husband is a chimney tech, and literally his, like, memories, you know, slideshow will come up every year, and it will be like, what I love, and it was a guess, and it's just pictures of chimneys, strangers' chimneys, over and over and over again. Not a one picture of me or our pets.
Rude.
And we have 3!
Get out your high-focusing computer pocket.
Come on. What is her husband's name again?
Carl.
Carl.
Carl. We do love Carl.
Mm.
Okay. It's also the name of the guy in Up, which makes me love him because he's an old man and he's an old man.
Nice old man.
Yeah. Carl wasn't always an old man, but the way I see him, he is. So, like I said earlier, she definitely haggles and, like, thrifts for things, but she said she doesn't love it.
Okay.
She doesn't love to haggle, but she does it because it is, like, culturally important and you have to know where you are. So she learned to haggle over time. She says in some places, if somebody offers you something for $50 and you take it, you ruin their day because they're like, well, I could have told him it was $100. So you haggle down a little bit just to, like, make the person feel like they made a sale. That's all part of the game. She didn't want to sell her business in 1992, but she was made an offer that she couldn't refuse. And the next stuff in her life, she decided was way more fun anyway. For a long time, the majority of her career, she was really well known in the industry. People wrote articles about her, but it's all, like, jargon. Like, oh, Iris did this, Iris did that. But she wasn't famous.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people would be like, oh, you need a good interior designer and you're wealthy. Let's go to Iris and mm-hmm. her husband. Because they did own the business together.
Mm-hmm.
But more generally, she's an industry secret.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Met, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, has this rotating show. Mm-hmm. You know how like you have the one thing that comes in the museum that then leaves? Mm-hmm. They had a show get canceled and they were like, what are we going to do? How are we going to fill the space? And one of the guys there was like, well, I'm really close with this interior designer named Iris and she has this amazing collection of like clothing and jewelry and we can probably set it up pretty easy so that it's there for a little bit and then we can take it out and it's not a big deal. So she becomes a couture outfit, jewelry, costume lender to the Met.
Oh my God.
So it's this remarkable collection. The museum, it is the first ever time that we know of that a museum is mounting like clothing as art. So it's not like a store where things are purchased. It's like this woman is an artist and she shows it through her clothes. Mm. And I mean, all ages, all races, all walks of life are starting to surround Iris mm-hmm. because she comes in. I mean, she took her own clothing from her own closets and jewelry and leaves it at the Met for people to look at while she's alive wearing her yeah. other clothes. That's incredible because she had to pick from all of her amazing clothes. And from yeah. what I've heard, being in her home was a total trip. It was like super kitschy. Christmas lights are up 6 to 8 months out of the year. Mm-hmm. She's got like weird shit everywhere that she bought all over the world. Several rooms in her New York apartment were all closets, double height. So they all have two shelves.
Oh my gosh.
Her mom's apartment in New York was filled with her clothes. Her apartment in Palm Beach is filled with her clothing. And because it was a last minute show, it all had to be advertised word of mouth.
Oh my God.
And what Iris did not expect is for that this, or the Met, is that for this one woman show to be the phenom that it was. And the show changed her life. She went from being a relatively unknown businesswoman that some people write about to being a starlet in her older years.
Yeah.
The show was so successful because it was colorful and it was playful. And a lot of people yearned for their lives to look like that and to feel confident in those clothing. And as much as she complains about being tired, she loved every fucking minute of it. Every minute. Because it changed her life. She went from being a normal everyday business person to getting 50 phone calls a day, being called the rare bird of fashion. Iris became a visiting professor at the University of Texas Austin in the fashion, you know, department. She performed on television commercials in France and Australia. She did a collaboration with like a technology company to make up smart jewelry. She wrote her own autobiography, Iris Apfel, Accidental Icon. And like in 2019, at the age of 97, she signed a modeling contract and she's like the oldest model to like grace most covers of most magazines. And it's because like brands like Tommy Hilfiger were constantly asking her for photo shoots. And she was like, well, I may as well get representation. And a lot of people, when she became a model, started asking, have you ever considered plastic surgery? And she was like, no. Why mess with what I was put on earth for? What? Why? For a few wrinkles?
Yeah.
Who cares? She's like, right. If I take the wrinkles off my face, you're just going to see my crony old hands.
Well, and also, it's like, I'm literally getting famous now looking the way that I look.
I'm 97.
So, like, what? Who cares? And yeah. Also, it's like, what, I get on my wrinkles room, and they're like, well, now you don't look like Iris Apfel.
Right. We want you to look how you look.
Yeah.
Iris and Carl did not have children. They didn't want to drag children around them all over the world. They were traveling a lot, and it was a decision that they made that Iris did not want her child to be raised by a nanny. I think we have more accessibility to it now mm-hmm. that you can travel and have a child.
Yeah.
Especially with a lot of online education, mm-hmm. things like that. The documentary that I watched, which you can rent or buy on Amazon Prime, if you have the premium, it's free, was released at the New York Film Festival in 2014 and then distributed to the U.S. in 2015. And she just, like, was such an icon after all of this, she was one of the inspirations for Edna Mode in The Incredibles. She is the oldest woman to ever have a Barbie doll made in her likeness. She was considered in 2013 the best dressed over 50. She got an award from the UN General Assembly. She's Woman Entrepreneur of the Year. And in 2021, Iris celebrated her 100th birthday. But just this year, on March 1st, at the age of 102, Iris passed away in her Palm Beach home. Beyond her impact in fashion, she redesigned the aging industry. She's the oldest woman to ever have a makeup collection, the oldest woman to model on the cover of some magazines. And it reminds us that it's never too late to start something new or to go in a new direction. She never said, ever, I don't like that person's outfit. She never put people down because she said, if you feel good wearing it, do it. Mm-hmm. But she did say, why keep doing the same thing every day? That's not a life. You may as well jump in the box yourself. And that's Iris. Iris Apfel.
I was not disappointed in her story at all. I loved it.
What a little dream she is.
I also didn't realize that she became famous so late in life.
Yeah, I thought that this was a long-term thing.
Well, like, I always thought that she was, like, an inner industry person, yeah, but, like, not to the extent that she really was,
right,
an industry secret. Like, right, that was wild.
People didn't know, and it's like she didn't become famous until the Met was like, shit, we're, yeah, shit out of luck. So they took the industry secret and made it public.
Yeah.
And now, like many museums, you can walk in and fashion is one of the things that they show. Yeah. There's a First Lady exhibit in D.C. Mm-hmm. I've been to the Princess Diana collection at Kensington Palace. Like, I've been to several museums, mm-hmm, that show fashion exclusively because it,
yeah,
is art.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, you're a designer. You can design clothing as, yeah, well. So what a coolie.
Perfect. Well, let's talk about these two ladies in conversation with each other in a little segment we like to call
Just the Two of Us.
Okay. I am obsessed with the fact that these women were just like from a young age were like, this is my path. I'm going to stick to it.
Yeah.
like there was no deviation from the path. It's like, I'm gonna be in design in this world, and Maria was like, I'm gonna be in education, and like, that was it.
And it's neither of them were about seeking praise. Like, no. Some people get into an industry, mm-hmm, to be famous, which I don't want to throw shade at. Like, if you, no, want your work to be known, like, go for it and do it. These women were just about the grind.
They fell in love with the work,
right?
And that's what I really liked about it, because they saw the work as bigger than the work, you, right, know. They were like, this is a part of our environment, this is a part of the physical community that we are a part of. It's like, I mean, Maria's literally like, this is the school system that is teaching the young minds that are going to like be a part of the community. And like, I felt like Iris was doing the same thing of like, why don't we take what's good in the community and expand on it? Like, let's work with what's here.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? I feel like you can look at children and antiques in this, like, very similar way, mm, of like, hey, we have this thing here that's good. We have a kid that is like, has so much potential. And like, why don't we do the best that we can with the kids that are here? Because, mm-hmm, I feel like a lot of the school system has been built on like, well, we want the best kids from the best neighborhoods, and like, we want to put all of our attention towards them. And she's like, why don't we just put our best effort into the kids that are right here in front of us?
Right.
And I feel like Iris was doing the same thing of like, why don't we take the things that we have and the patterns and the fabrics that we have and like incorporate them into our lives and make it beautiful, you know? It's like just making what is there incredible, because it's possible.
Well, because things already exist.
Yeah.
Like, I see a lot of young, famous people who, mm-hmm, go on to, like, go into design. Like, if you go to Kohl's, you can buy Lauren Conrad jewelry or this, that, or the other.
A timely reference.
Right. These two people did something totally opposite.
Yeah.
Instead of creating something new, they took what already existed and, mm-hmm, like, put some spit shine on it. It was
exactly,
like, we have these things. We, yes, don't have to produce a new thing.
Yes.
It already exists.
Well, also because I think they were taking, like,
these skills that, yes, you can teach. Like, you can teach the skill of teaching. You can teach the skill of interior design, fashion design, but you can't teach the passion behind it.
Right.
Not everyone can be an Iris. Not everyone can be a Maria. Mm-mm. And you just... But you also need those people to move the whole industry forward.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the other thing. It's like, I also want people to know that, like, you don't have to be them in order to be successful in the industry. But, like, you do need a couple people like that to move it forward and do really cool things. Because, like, you need teachers who are just there every day doing their consistent things. And then you need people who are like, we need a PTA in the school.
I mean, you need, like... I think they were both industry promoters.
Yes.
And neither of them did the industry thing, like I said earlier, to be famous. They just kept at the grind and got noticed.
Industry secrets turned legends.
Right.
That's what they both are.
Right. That's exactly right.
Like, maybe Maria would never be known to people who weren't in, like, the specific field of, like, education and, you know, specifically, like, New England education, you know, but really she did a lot to affect a ton of people. And that's what Iris was. Like, I also love that the presidents figured into both of their stories.
Oh,
that, like,
yeah.
Maria was also getting famous doing speeches about presidents. And then Iris was just, like, low key designing the White House, like, just, like, in the fucking White House. I think that's so cool that they also both have this influence over this very traditionally male-dominated institution.
Right, and I think the two of them together, if you take their lifespans, they are American history, right?
Yeah.
Like, they, when was Maria born?
1856.
Right, so 1856 to, what, 2024? That's a really fucking long time, and
it's
that's
a long time.
Two actual humans because they overlapped in history by 1 year.
By
so,
1 year.
When you think about life like that, you think about, like, the grand scheme of America and how it's changed. But these women and their passion is so similar. And I absolutely love that.
Yeah. Well, because you need passionate people to, like, move the world forward. You know what I'm saying? And, like, not everyone has to be... Not everyone has to be a world mover, but they do have to exist.
Right.
And, like, I am a person that is totally willing to, like,
exist,
give them the reins.
I will never.
I love these women. I love that, you know, we randomly paired them together, and I actually felt like they had a lot in common with each other. And, like, they're in these fields that, like, they're also both in fields that people all the time think of as, like, oh, I could do that. Like, how hard is interior designing? You pick out a cool couch.
Right.
You know, how hard is teaching? You just go in the classroom and read the textbook. You know what I'm saying? It's like fields that are underappreciated. Like, my best friend is an interior designer.
And she's so talented.
And she's so talented. And also, it is such hard work because people think that it's picking out a beautiful rug and a couch. But no, it is picking out the couch and then finding a really cool fabric from another designer.
Right.
And then finding out how to get that fabric onto that couch,
right,
and also matching it to, like, the Roman shades that you picked out from another custom designer and making sure the light switches match. And, like, it is so much more than people think. And so is children's education. People think that it is reading Hop on Pop, and it is an incredibly important time when you're literally molding a young brain. Like, we've talked about this a lot, but, like, there's just a lot more respect that I think can be given to these fields. And I think these are the epitome of women who should be respected for their contributions to the field.
I think the best way to describe it is, like, everybody has an Instagram. Not everybody's a photographer.
Yes!
Like, you can tell. Like, you can, like, and I always know by the end of March that I am not a photographer. I can never figure out angles. I can never figure out lighting. I oversaturate everything. Like, during the women's history pictures, it's so hard, and I'm not trained or educated in it, and I know right. that, you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. like,
and it doesn't mean they're not good,
right?
Like, they're great. I love these photos.
But giving
every
you a
year.
Camera doesn't make but, you a professional.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the same thing with these women.
Yeah,
like, just because you can do it doesn't mean it is your thing, and for these women it is their thing.
So their thing.
Their thing. Okay.
All right, well, let's toast these women okay. and other people like them. Who yeah. would you like to toast?
So as I said earlier, like, I definitely felt a call to just, like, buy things I'm interested in mm. instead of worrying about how people feel about me. So mm-hmm. I'm going to toast to people who march to the beat of their own drum.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah.
Cheers.
And I think specifically my little sister, like, I... Now that she lives with me, she sees that I have breakdowns over my clothes very often. Like, mm. I have, like, anxiety breakdowns before I go somewhere. I'm like, what if I'm too fancy? Mm. What if I'm not fancy mm-hmm. enough? Mm-hmm. What if this? What if that? What if I wear this? And then they think I don't care.
Yeah. I have the same breakdowns.
And I really, like, fall apart about it. And, like, my little sister will wear a dress and full eye makeup everywhere she goes because she's like, I don't care. This yeah. is what I feel like I look good in, so I'm going to wear it. Mm. And she doesn't care what everybody else is wearing. And I'm like, that is so brave.
And like, it's a level beyond me.
Right. I've like learned a lot from her saying that, but I yeah. haven't like ingrained it into myself yet. So like, I'm still working on that.
I, when I was younger, I realized that I had a problem with people pleasing when I would order soda at restaurants because someone else ordered soda and they were the only one, and I wanted to make them feel comfortable, so I would, even though I didn't want one,
right?
And I was like, oh, I think this might be like a problem of mine, that like, I don't want to go to an event wearing something different because mm-hmm. like, I don't want anyone else to feel like uncomfortable that like they didn't dress
the way they were supposed to dress.
Still working on it.
Yeah.
I should get a therapist.
I think we all should. But I also think, and this could probably be a Patreon discussion, like, neither of our moms were big fashionistas.
Ooh, that's
so
true.
So we didn't mm-hmm. learn a lot about makeup and hair and styling from our mothers. So it's kind of like a late in life thing. And it's like, well, if I start it now, I'm going to look weird.
Yeah. My mom has literally had 3 purses in the entire time I've known her, which is now 30 years. A purse per decade. And the first one,
a PPP one,
was
might
a
say.
Fanny.
Oh, PPD.
Was a fanny pack
yeah.
that she would just carry on her shoulder.
Well, that's in now.
Well, yeah, but she would just, but not over her chest, like cool. Like, she would just carry it on her shoulder like a purse. Yeah. And this one was most recent. But yeah, anyways.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Tell me who you're toasting.
I am going to toast the women on the committees. My God, she was on a lot of committees, and we need those people.
We do.
I know sometimes it can feel tedious, and it can feel like your committee is not doing what it should be. Sometimes the meetings are bullshit. Sometimes they're very important, but we need you there. So I want to toast the women on committees because she definitely left no committee unattended in the New England area in the 1800s.
Good for her. Cheers. Cheers.
All right. What are you enjoying in pop culture this week?
So we said this off mic. I'm really enjoying the new, like, Moses show. It's a mini series on Netflix, the Bible Moses, or the Torah Moses, or the Quran Moses, whatever. It's a 3-episode series, an hour and a half each, and it's a really cool historic and multi-theological retelling of Moses's life. Mm. It's one of those where they have the historians comment, and then they have the dramatic, like, replaying of it. And I love a great documentary, but I also, as I told Katie earlier, like, that is my favorite Bible story. Like, mm-hmm. if the book of Exodus is the only one that I care for.
Yeah.
So that's the story I could hear over and over again, and I just think it's so cool. It's like a rags to riches to rags story. And I really am enjoying it. It's very comforting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's something that I celebrated so strongly in my youth and like mm-hmm. don't celebrate as much now. So it's very comforting to just like have those little religious connections yeah. that I don't have anymore.
Yeah. Perfect.
What are you liking?
I am going to like, because I do, the $1 Trader Joe's cards.
I go to that's why I do my grocery shopping, Trader Joe's, and because it's frankly cheaper than the regular grocery store at this point, which is bananas. I love Trader Joe's, and they have this whole beautiful display of $1 cards, and they're just beautiful. And they're a dollar. So every time I'm there, I look at them, and a lot of times I don't buy any, you know, I don't buy them because, like, they're whatever. But they have really pretty illustrations, and some of them are just so fucking cute. Like, I bought this one this week that was just, like, all these, like, purple flowers on it. And I was like, I'm going to buy that, and I'm going to send it to a friend when I think of it. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
I'm not even thinking of a friend in particular. Like, that's just a card I would send to a friend when I feel like they might be feeling down. So, like, I would love to recommend that. Also, speaking of friends that might be down, and maybe I'll send this card to Maura. Maura's sister passed away a few years ago, and there is a whole, like, organization set up to raise money to send other kids to writing therapy. Okay, so it is from the Freedom Reigns Therapeutic Writing Center, and it's the Bethany Thornton Memorial Scholarship. She passed away in 2022, and she found great relief and joy in riding horses, which so many people do, and this is a scholarship to benefit applicants of all disabilities or financial needs with therapeutic riding lessons.
Perfect. You know? Yeah.
I mean, this is such a great opportunity to give back and to provide people with a sense of comfort, because I feel like a lot of times we don't want people who are struggling to have even a little bit of a nice thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's seen as like, well, that's luxurious. It's like, well, you know what? People who are struggling may also want to feel taken care of. And I, like,
everybody needs a little breaky break.
Yeah. And so I just think this is a great thing to donate to. So, again, it's put on by the Freedom Reigns Therapeutic Riding Center. We'll put it in our stories and stuff. But yeah, if you want to donate to the Bethany Thornton Memorial Scholarship, please do, because I think it's a great opportunity to help some folks get some relief.
Wonderful.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for listening. We hope to see you next week on another episode of our little show. If you'd like to join us on Patreon, please do. We always talk about really fun things.
And Katie has, like, some new designs coming up.
Yes,
soon.
I do, with our merch. So they're going to be coming on Teespring. Wherever we sell them, I think, yeah, Teespring.
Teespring's right, yeah.
Yeah, so be on the lookout for that. I've been on my little computer just designing little new things for us to sell, which will be really fun. So be on the lookout for that. Join our Patreon. Rate and review us if you can. And never forget that well-behaved women
never put their passions out there.
No, and they rarely make history.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Her Story on the Rocks. We are independently produced by 1986 Entertainment and proudly recorded in Baltimore, Maryland. If there's a woman in history you would like us to cover, you can email us at herstoryontherocks@gmail.com. You can also message us on Twitter or Instagram. We post all of our cocktail recipes on Tuesdays so that you can go get all the supplies you need and drink along with us. See you next week. Bye.